Good morning.
I hope you guys had a great weekend. We're going to finish up the limiting reactant stuff today, knock this out. On Friday, we left off with this example of how you can take 2 gram amounts for a reaction and figure out what the limiting reactant is. And I think I like this way overall best, but it is not the only way to do it. So if you're used to doing it another way, you totally can. In the problem we're looking at, we started with grams of chlorine and grams of aluminum. It may or may not say look for limiting reactant, but you should look for limiting reactant and stuff to see that you've got it. So go grams to moles to grams. And that's going to be our mantra here now for a while. So in this case, take grams of chlorine and grams of aluminum and turn them into moles. There's then a ratio from the balanced reaction. And on Friday, we saw that it was 2 aluminums and 3 Cl2, making 1 Al2Cl6. So the reason for the 3-to-1 ratio there is because there are 3 moles of chlorine for every 1 Al2Cl6. And the reason for the 1/2 right there, 2 moles of aluminum create 1 mole of Al2Cl6. So since we're starting with the reactants go on the bottom, but the top number is always just 1. Then you multiply it by the molar mass of this Al2Cl6, and you can see that you get 2 gram amounts. So the chlorine will create this much Al2Cl6, and the aluminum will create this much. The smaller number is what you're after. That's the limiting reactant speaking there. It's only creating 10.1 grams of the dimer. The excess reactant will say it's creating more. And this is like if you have, like, I don't know, 8 hot dog buns and 6 hot dogs, all right? You can't make then 8 sandwiches, 8 hot dogs and hot dog buns because you only have 6 hot dogs. Your hot dogs are limiting how much final hot dog plus bun you can make. In this problem, not quite as tasty, chlorine is limiting how much Al2Cl6 you can make. You're only going to make 10.1 grams. You will not be able to make 26.6. So the limiting reactant idea creates the value for the theoretical yield of product. And the other reactant is called the excess reactant. And if Daria is my boss and I say, oh yeah, we'll be making 26.6 grams Al2Cl6, and she sees I'll make 10.1 grams or less, because this is theoretical yield, not actual yield, pink slip, I'm fired, looking for a new job. So chemists need to know this kind of stuff. It's about the control of the reaction. We need to know the maximum amount of product made. And in this case, it's 10.1 grams. She will laugh at me, if, knowing the chemistry that she knows now, if I start quoting 26.6 grams, that is too big. Any questions on that? All right, the last thing we need to do is we need to figure out how much of the excess reactant is left, all right? So chlorine, all the chlorine's gonna be used up and stuff like that. The aluminum is the excess. But if aluminum is an expensive metal, and it's not always the cheapest, maybe she'd like to know, well, why are you putting all the extra in? How much is left over at the end? So what we're gonna do now is we're gonna use that limiting reactant to calculate the grams of excess reactant left over at the end. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna first find how much aluminum was actually needed in the reaction, and we can subtract that amount from the total aluminum to find the aluminum in excess. So in this reaction, we figured out the other day on Friday that there were 0.200 moles of aluminum and 0.114 moles of chlorine. And this again is the limiting reactant. And that's where we want to start this reaction from. Always start your reactions from the limiting reactant. So if we're going back to moles of a reactant here, I will use the fact that there are 3 moles of chlorine used for every 2 moles of aluminum in the reaction. And again, this 2/3 ratio just comes from the balanced reaction. 3 Cl2s are used up for every 2 aluminums that are used up. So 0.0760, those are the moles of aluminum that were actually needed in this reaction. So what you can do then is if you know the moles of aluminum total, which is 0.2, you can subtract 0.0760 moles of aluminum to calculate that you have 0.124 moles of aluminum in excess. And if you multiply that number by the molar mass of aluminum on the periodic table, it's about 27 grams per mole. That's where this 3.35 number comes from. That's the grams of unused aluminum in this reaction. And again, maybe there's a reason why we had so much extra aluminum. Maybe there's not, but at least you can calculate it and you can communicate with the bosses who worry about the bottom line and money and things. I don't understand working at a community college, but anyway, you can at least talk to them then about what's going on. All right, last topic we're gonna talk about is going back again to figuring out a formula. And in chemistry, most compounds have just carbon and hydrogen, but some have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. So if you have one of these kind of compounds, there's something called a combustion analysis that can be done on it. And all combustion means is that you're gonna burn it. If you watch Beavis and Butthead, you'll understand that reference. Anyway, burning things is fun. I mean, it's useful in a scientific perspective. Thank you for laughing. Anyway, because you can actually tell then some cool kind of information from it. And burning does nothing more than convert the carbon into carbon dioxide and the hydrogen into water. And if you can collect that CO2 and water at the end, you can turn those back into moles of carbon and moles of hydrogen and find the reactions from there, the formulas from there. This is a little animation, and it shows the stuff actually burning. And I think I'm supposed to ask this. Oh, maybe not. Anyway. Okay, for some reason my sound is not projecting on the projector. I apologize for that. We will go without it. Anyway, what it said basically is that you take a sample of either something with carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, stuff like that, and you're just going to burn it. Come on, you can come on down to the front. Just make yourself at home. Don't worry about it. We're all friends here, man. So good to have you, Rebecca. Anyway, you're taking some kind of nasty, oily compound, which is what all these things are, in my opinion, and you're burning it. And the burning, it means it's placed in oxygen, makes CO2 and water. And you can have different kind of hydrated compounds form. Hydrated compounds, we've seen, are compounds that absorb water. They collect the water on them. And you can also have compounds that absorb the CO2. And from these kind of things then, you can back calculate the moles of C and the moles of H. Now, for every CO2 that forms, how many carbons did he have? What's the ratio of moles of CO2 to moles of C? 1:1. Well done. A mole of CO2 has to come from a mole of carbon because there's one carbon in CO2, so that moles of CO2 will equal the moles of carbon in our initial thing. If this would have been C5 right here, there would be 5 CO2s created. Now, what is the ratio of water to hydrogen? What does that 2 mean right there? 2, that's right. Every mole of water comes from two moles of hydrogen. So if this would have been a 10 right there, H10, I would have 5 moles of water. Because the hydrogen all ends up with water, just like the carbon all ends up in CO2. So this mole ratio thing is really helpful in determining formulas as well. So let's look at an example of how this works out. I'm taking 0.115 grams of a hydrocarbon, I'm burning the heck out of it, and I end up creating 0.379 grams of CO2 and this many grams of water. We can use this information to find the empirical formula of this CxHy. And again, remember, X and Y are nothing more than moles. I want to find moles of hydrogen and moles of carbon. And we'll compare those two in order to find this formula CxHy. The carbon will come from the CO2, so grams to moles CO2, moles CO2 to moles of carbon. And the water, grams of water, moles of water, I'll multiply it by 2, like Leo North said, to get moles of hydrogen then. So what it looks like, here's the puddle, and all these things are nasty, oily, basically gasoline-like substances. And like, but remember, I'm an inorganic chemist, and I like metals and colors. But anyway, we're taking this puddle, we're burning it. All the carbon ends up as CO2, and it's a 1-to-1 ratio of carbon to CO2. The hydrogen, on the other hand, I burn it, it creates water, and it's 2 hydrogens for every 1 water molecule. So, mathematically, what we're going to do, we're going to first find the amount of carbon. So if you take 0.379 grams and you turn it to moles, you get this number right here. How did I go from grams of CO2 again to moles of CO2? Periodic table, that's right. The other major answer, it's either grams to moles or periodic table. Those are basically the answers in this class. All right, I should be more elaborate than that. Yeah, look at the periodic table. 1 carbon and 2 oxygens would be 12 grams plus 2 times 16. It's about 44 grams per mole. So 0.379 divided by 44 is how I got that number right there. And for this problem, a CO2 comes from a mole of carbon. So the moles of CO2 equal your moles of carbon. You can do the similar kind of thing with water. You can take grams of water, turn it into moles of water by dividing by about 18 to get this number right here. But water has 2 hydrogens. So for every mole of water, I need to multiply by 2. That gets this number right here, the moles of hydrogen. So grams CO2 to moles of CO2, 1-to-1 gives us moles of carbon. Grams of water to moles of water, using the molar mass of water, times 2 gives us the moles of hydrogen. And this question. At this point then, you have the moles of C and the moles of H. So like on the other formulas you've seen so far, bigger divided by the smaller. 10 to the minus 3 is smaller than 10 to the minus 2. It comes out to be 1.33 in your calculators when you put those numbers in. 1.33 is like 1 1/3 or 4/3. Empirical formulas, nasty thing. C3H4. Any questions on that? Okay, so this part isn't too bad, all right, because the CO2 correlates to moles of carbon, and the moles of water correlate to moles of hydrogen. But some of the organic compounds have not just carbon and hydrogen, but they also have oxygen. And if you've heard of compounds like ketones and aldehydes and alcohols, is actually a type of a chemical in chemistry, all of those have not just carbon and hydrogen, but they also have oxygen. And oxygen is kind of a tough thing to deal with here, because oxygen appears in all the reactants and all of the products. So, caproic acid is an example of a compound that has carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. It's got all 3 this time. And we're taking 0.450 grams of it, and we're burning it, just like before. And we end up with this much water and this much carbon dioxide. Also note here that we have the molar mass of the whole compound, 116.2. We can use this information to find the molecular formula of caproic acid. And what we're going to do here is we're first going to find the moles of carbon and the moles of hydrogen. We'll find the moles of carbon from the moles of CO2, which we can turn this into. We can find the moles of hydrogen from the moles of water, which we'll turn that into. But the question is, how do you get the moles of oxygen? This caproic acid has oxygen in it. We're adding oxygen to burn it. We end up making oxygen in CO2 and oxygen in water. So oxygen is in every one of our species, both reactants and both products. So the oxygen here, we have to use kind of a special technique to isolate it. And so that's why we're going through this example. And again, the problem is that oxygen is just so freaking social, quote unquote. Oxygen in the product reactant, adding oxygen, it's in CO2 and it's in water. So you can't go from like moles of water to moles of oxygen in the compound because CO2 has some moles of oxygen too. So check this out. This is a special technique that we'll use just when we have a compound with CH and O. Now to start this problem, it's the same as what we just did with that C3H4 thing. We're going to turn the grams of water into moles of water, which is the 18.02 number. And water has two hydrogens in it, so there are two H's per water. 0.0464 moles of hydrogen are in the original compound. And that's like what we did on the last problem. But there's another little part right here. I'm going to take the moles of hydrogen and turn it into grams of hydrogen, because this is now just H, and hydrogen's about 1.01 grams, 0.0469 grams of hydrogen. I can do the same thing with the carbon and from the carbon dioxide. And this is like what we did with the C3H4. Grams of CO2 to moles of CO2. A mole of C comes from a mole of CO2. This is the moles of carbon. And that's the same as before. But now you can see that what I've done is I've taken that same number and I turned it into grams of carbon. So in the last problem with C3H4, we would have taken moles of hydrogen and moles of carbon, compared them, and be done. But this fascist thing has some oxygen in it, so we need to figure out the moles of oxygen. And because oxygen's in everything, you can't take just like moles of carbon dioxide and turn it into moles of oxygen, because oxygen is also in water. So what you can do is figure out grams of carbon and grams of hydrogen. Whoops, I circled the wrong one there, sorry. 0.450 grams represents all of the carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen in this caproic acid. And what we've just calculated here is grams of C and grams of H. This is all the C, H, and O. So this minus these 2 gram amounts is how we're going to find the grams of oxygen that's just in the sample. All right? Doesn't come from O2, doesn't blah, blah, blah. This is like law of mass action. All the grams that go in have to be accounted for on the way back out. So 0.450 grams is all the C, H, and O in that sample. And we've just calculated the C and, oops, I better not use that finger. Sorry, having fun with my fingers here. We just calculated the C and the H, so now we're gonna isolate the grams of oxygen in that sample. Here's a little bit more graphic way to show it. So 0.450 grams is the grams of the caproic acid. We're gonna subtract the grams of carbon and the grams of hydrogen that we calculated on the last slide. And this number, 0.124 grams, is the grams of just oxygen now in the sample. And this is the best way to calculate the grams of oxygen in a sample that starts with oxygen in and of itself. Oxygen is just so social, we can't use mole-to-mole ratios with anything because it's in more than one place. If you take this number and you turn it into moles, you get 0.0075775 moles of oxygen. And now we have the moles of carbon from before, we have the moles of hydrogen from before, and we have moles of oxygen. So now we've got CH and O, we're ready to go. Now we can start doing a formula. Any questions on this, how we found the grams of oxygen? Okay, so now that we have the moles, we'll take all those three numbers, we'll divide by the smallest one, which is 0.0075. So 0.00775 divided by itself is just 1. If you take this number and you put it in the denominator under this number, it's a 3 to 1 ratio. That's where the 3 comes from. And 0.0464 divided by 0.00775 is a ratio of 6. So the empirical formula of this caproic acid, C3H6O. Now, this question is looking for the molecular formula. The molecular formula, we will need the molar mass of the whole thing, which is this number, and the molar mass of our empirical formula. So if you add up 3 carbons, 6 hydrogens, and an oxygen, which would be 12 times 3, 36, plus 6 times 1, another 6 would be 42, I think, and 42 plus 16 is about 58. That number is the molar mass of the empirical formula. And you can see how the molar mass of the whole thing, 116, divided by the molar mass of the empirical formula, 58, 116 divided by 58, it's about a ratio of 2. So 2 times the empirical formula gives us the molecular formula, which is C6H12O2. So you can see how all this stuff kind of like begins to fall into place. there's more than one way to find these different formulas. This method we just looked at works really great for finding like vitamin C. It works for finding things like caffeine. Things with carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen fall really well in this category. Any questions? All right, that's enough of this crazy stuff, so let's get out of that. And let's start looking into the part of chemistry, which is probably even more important, which is the study of solutions. Now, in this last section, we looked at chemical reactions and how you can take reactants, put them into products, theoretical yields. But the solution is really important in chemistry. It's when you take something and you dissolve it, usually in water, but it can be in different things. And they tend to react a little bit faster. So this next section is really on solution stoichiometry and how it relates to reactions. So solution is what we'll talk about first, stoichiometry, ratio of reactants to products, and of course how those both apply then to chemical reactions. Now, if you have a solution, you have something called a solvent. And a solvent is nothing more than the bulk. So I love to use the idea of Kool-Aid, which is probably really bad for you thinking now on the bigger soda thing, but that's okay. If you've ever had Kool-Aid, you buy these little packets sometimes at the store, you place the powdered stuff in water and you stir it up and you taste it. It's kind of sweet tasting and they have different flavors and they're probably all artificial, blah, blah, blah. Kool-Aid is an example of a solution. The solvent is the water. It's the bulk thing, the thing that takes up most of your part. Technically, it's the component whose physical state is preserved. So Kool-Aid a solid and water a liquid. The solution looks like a liquid, all right? So we still have a liquid at the end. The liquid would be the water, and that's technically the solvent. But it's really not the solvent we're after most of the time, it's the solute. And the solute is nothing more than the exciting part. Now notice here how we have a solution, which equals a solvent plus a solute. All of these terms begin with S-O-L, and I'm very sorry about that. S-O-L has another meaning in common culture. We will not use it in this G-rated class. However, I do bring this up to recognize that you've got to realize there's solute, solvent, and solution. They all begin with S-O-L. Please make sure you know which one you're talking about or you'll end up S-O-L. Okay, if you know what it means. Okay, so, sorry, it's still early, I know, and caffeine hasn't kicked in. Something about something out of luck. I can't remember what the S stands for exactly. But anyway, in this G-rated class, we have to keep it clean. That's right. Anyway, let's move on. Sometimes they'll talk about compounds that are soluble and insoluble. Soluble just means that things dissolve in your solvent and you can make a solution. If you have a compound which is insoluble, they stay as solids in the water and you don't have a solution. So a solution happens when the solute dissolves in the solvent. If they are insoluble, they stay as solids and you don't have a solution. And this is something we'll start talking about. Now this is kind of an example of what's going on here. I think this is a nickel compound, and we're going to place the nickel compound in some liquid water to make a nickel solution. Whoa, I guess we're not going to see that right now, so sorry about that. Oh, sorry. Any questions on solute, solvent, solvent? Okay. So no, we go ahead.
All right.
Yeah.
You said that it's the one who has a physical state is preserved. So does that mean when you drop solid into water, it like turns into a liquid, or it just looks like it's drained?
Cool. You see the solid disappear, and we'll talk about what disappear means here in a little bit, but you still see the bulk liquid. If you're solid, like if you put a rock in water, it goes to the bottom, that rock stays there, okay? That would not be a solution. That would be something that's insoluble in water. But if you put like sugar in water, okay, the sugar, you stir it up and the sugar goes away, disappears, that would be a sugar solution then. Cool. Okay. Knowing when things dissolve in water and when they don't are really important. And something we're going to do in lab this week is use a table like this one. And this is something we'll talk about in lab this week, definitely. But all this is kind of a cheat sheet to tell when things dissolve in water and when they don't. Now, talking to Mackenzie, I think most people know putting rocks in water, no problem, they stay. Putting sugar in water, it dissolves. Everybody may not know what happens when you have magnesium acetate or something like that. So this is like a list that helps chemists to know when things dissolve in water and when they don't. And this is the one we'll use in Chem 221. There are basically four quadrants, the light blue, the dark blue, the light blue here, and the dark blue here. Everything in the upper light blue quadrant is a soluble compound, which means it dissolves in water. These are exceptions. These are insoluble in water. And if you want to write on here, insoluble, cross out exceptions and just put insoluble, that's totally fine. Now these, we'll see here, are insoluble. These are like rocks. You place them in water, they don't dissolve. These over here are soluble. So again, if you want to write soluble right here, that's totally cool. So let's say that Blake does bring me some magnesium acetate. I haven't dealt a lot with magnesium acetate, but we can use this guide to make a prediction if it's going to be soluble or not. Acetate is the key, all right? Magnesium doesn't show up a lot of times here, but notice how acetate always soluble, and soluble means makes a solution. So Blake brings me magnesium acetate. Acetate's right here. There are no exceptions to this one. Water soluble. Amir brings me some acetate. And I, as the chemist, don't know what means, all right? And I'm kind of scared. I'm trying to make it look like I'm not. However, I hear the word acetate in what he says. Aha! Acetate, in Chem 221 anyway, always soluble, no exceptions. So I'll say, oh, Amir, well, I think that will dissolve in water. Because I don't know what means, but I do know that acetate, no exceptions to it. Now, some of these do have exceptions. Most chlorides are water soluble, all right? Nickel 2 chloride, sodium chloride, however, silver chloride, silver 1 chloride, is an exception. This would be one that doesn't dissolve. If you have magnesium chloride, it would be soluble. Silver chloride would not be soluble. This does not make a solution, all right? Over here, you can see that most sulfates are soluble, barium sulfate is not. So in this case, magnesium sulfate, water soluble like most sulfates, but barium is an exception. This would make a solid. It does not dissolve. Now, these are the opposite. These are always insoluble with a few exceptions, all right? So let's say that, who can I pick on here? Nick brings me some blah, 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 chromate. All right. I don't know what blah, blah, blah is because I haven't studied my polytopics. I'm still linking up, don't have enough caffeine, whatever. Doesn't matter. Chromates, usually insoluble. We would not expect that to dissolve. But there are some exceptions over here. All right. Ammonium and the alkali metals. Alkali metals are sodium, potassium, lithium. All right. So Sam brings me some sodium carbonate. Most carbonates would be insoluble, but sodium is an alkali metal. That one would dissolve. If it dissolves, you put an AQ next to it. If it's insoluble, though, then you wouldn't put AQ. You would leave it as an S, like it was solid. AQ is what we're going to use to designate a solution. So here are just three examples of compounds. Barium nitrate, barium chloride, barium sulfate. All right. Nitrates are one of the ones always AQ. No exceptions to it. Blah, blah, blah. Nitrate, AQ. Put it down. All right. Chlorides, usually AQ, unless it's one of these. Barium is not silver, mercury, or lead, so it would be AQ and soluble. But if we wanted to know if barium sulfate was soluble, well, most sulfates are soluble, but wait, barium is an exception. This one, we would not write BaSO4AQ. You would write BaSO4 with an S next to it. It does not dissolve in water. We will use this more in lab this time. It works really well. We will use this guy all the way through Chem 223. It's not perfect. We'll see lots of exceptions to this as we go along. And we'll look at an even better way to do solubility in Chem 223. But for right now, or to be honest, when someone from Chem 104 attacks me, not literally attacks, but comes up to me in the hallway and says, Russell, you have a PhD. You must know if the blah, 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 phosphate is water soluble or not. Well, if that blah, blah is not ammonium, sodium, potassium, lithium, I can say with pretty high confidence it's going to be insoluble. Blake.
What happens if you have, say, potassium chloride and silver? Would potassium and chloride mixed with silver wouldn't be soluble, or the three combined and the compound itself would be soluble?
Right on. So this is what we're going to get into. And if you add potassium chloride with silver nitrate, the silver and the chloride will come together and make an insoluble compound. You bet. That's something we'll talk about here in a little bit. Yeah, Eleanor.
Did I understand correctly? If I mix acetate with silver, silver will not dissolve.
That's right.
But if I don't put gold?
Gold, yes.
Gold will dissolve.
Gold will dissolve. That's right. These are the only three with these guys that make insoluble compounds. Now, there are better rules we'll look at later, Eleonora, but for us in Chem 221, that's the answer I'd want you to give. That's right. Excellent. Okay. So, again, that's kind of a list and stuff that's kind of crazy. If you want an even easier list, these guys right here are always going to be soluble. Sodium, potassium, lithium, ammonium nitrate, chloride, perchlorate, and acetate. Basically, these guys right here. And if you hear anybody say, blah, 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 chlorate or perchlorate, it's going to be water soluble all the time. If you're taking a quiz or an exam and I say, well, is blah, 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 acetate soluble? You say yes, because this is one of the ones, there's no exceptions to it. And these eight will show up a lot. Now, you'll also see chloride, bromide, and iodide a lot. Those are usually AQ with these couple of exceptions that Eleonora clued into. This would be the simplest solubility list to know slash memorize slash put in your calculators. This one is the one we'll use in lab to do a little bit better job. Okay, so which one of these is the only insoluble salt in water? Now, if you remember the list, all right, there were things like ammonium on there, there were things like nitrate, sodium ions, potassium ions, chlorides and lithiums, and all of those, if you look over here, all of those soluble all the time. There's no exceptions to it, all right? So ammonium is one of them. Nitrate is one of them. A is definitely going to be water soluble. B, hydroxides a lot of times are insoluble, but alkali metals and stuff are going to be water soluble. So that's also water soluble because of the sodium. Sodium trumps anything on here. But the iodides, although they're usually water soluble, lead is one of the ones that has an exception. So because lead is an exception to this rule, that's the one that you would say is not water soluble. Most iodides are, but lead is an exception. Not gold, but lead would be it.
But yeah. I love D. It says
steel. Cool. Carbonates absolutely are usually insoluble. But the alkali metals are ones that are that make it water soluble. And the alkali metals are the sodium, potassium, lithium, strontium. So it's the potassium here, Eleonora, that makes this water soluble. Good. I'm glad you saw it. Most of the time, blah, 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 carbonate, insoluble. All right? But these guys will trump that. And stuff. Other questions? So let's talk now about what exactly is happening when you make a solution. And again, I think I'm going to have some bad sound here, guys, so I'm just going to pump this up a little bit.
Potassium permanganate is an ionic compound. It dissolves readily when mixed with water. Dissolution involves the breaking of the bonds that hold the compound together.
This is potassium permanganate.
The ions become distributed throughout the water, forming a solution. Water molecules are made of hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen side of the molecule has a positive charge. The oxygen side is negative. When water molecules contact an ionic compound, such as potassium permanganate, their positive sides are attracted to the negative ions of the compound, and the negative sides of the H2O are attracted to the positive ions in the compound. These attractions allow the crystal lattice to break down and the compound dissolves.
So we put the purple solid in water and it turns kind of a cool purple color, by the way. It's pretty neat. So something is happening. A solution is being made. You no longer see the purple crystals anymore. You just see the purple liquid. All right. And what's happening on the atomic level? These down here represent the KMnO4. The yellow is the K, and this thing right here is the MnO4 minus, the permanganate ion. And what happens is water comes in and breaks it up. We're going to see that water is almost a very special compound. It has a part which is slightly positive and a site that's partly negative. So it surrounds the MnO4 minus and the K plus, and it basically pulls them away. All right, it breaks up this solid lattice, which is an incredible feat in and of itself. As the K plus is moved away with waters around it, that's when we would write K plus aqueous. It means the K's have been taken away from the KMnO4. They're surrounded by waters. That's where the aqueous part comes from. The waters have surrounded it. And MnO4 minus does the same thing. Waters will surround it, and as it pulls it away from the lattice, you end up with permanganate ions, MnO4 minus. So again, like almost everything with K, it's going to be water soluble, very easily water soluble. The K's dissociate from the KMnO4s. The permanganates also dissociate from the KMnO4s. And you end up with this kind of cool looking aqueous solution. Yeah.
I thought the group 1 metals reacted like violently with water. Why don't they do it now?
Totally. Pure potassium has 19 protons and 19 electrons. This is a K plus ion to balance the MnO4 minus ion. So that K plus has already lost its electron. So you can imagine that somewhere along the line, potassium with 19 protons and 19 electrons reacted with water or whatever. It lost an electron to make K plus. And here, the K plus, not K, is reacting with MnO4 minus to make KMnO4. So the compounds won't have the pure elements that react with water. And yeah, you wouldn't want to do that. They'll do, K plus is also in fake salt, KCO, sometimes used as a salt substitute. And you probably this morning had sodium chloride, which is Na plus and Cl minus. Your throat hopefully didn't explode or anything. So yeah, there's a difference between Na in it by itself and Na in a compound. The Na in a compound has lost its electron and it's safer. The Na with its electron would be really reactive and you wouldn't want to do it. Excellent question, man. So in a compound, it's different than the pure element because it has a different number of electrons. Other questions? Yeah.
You said that the water molecule pulls that amount of
formaldehyde
away. Could you elaborate on why, how it happens?
Water has a triangle shape. And this is something we'll be developing over the next couple chapters. And that gives it a slightly positive side and a slightly negative side. Now, for example, K plus is attracted to the negative right there. But what happens is the negative side of water surrounds the K plus, and it becomes a bigger attraction than it has for the negative of permanganate. So it like extracts it that way. If you've seen other classes, this if water is polar, all right? That's where we're going to, but we're not quite there yet, so I'm trying not to use those terms. Blake?
Are there any compounds where, like, when it's solid as solution, the water only takes part of it? Like, say, for this potassium, you know, for making it, say it's a compound where it only took potassium out, and where the, right, is there a situation where the permanganate can come together, not necessarily those exact compounds?
Cool.
But.
Yeah, it will take both of them equally if it's going to dissolve. If it's not going to dissolve, then this one would have like a stronger attraction and it wouldn't let go. These are primitive rules. We'll look at better ones later. Last question.
Is that not what happened in the lab where we found the copper? And the copper didn't dissolve and it made its own compound where the chloride dissolved in water?
Yes, the blue solid that you started with in water made a solution. That's right. So you ended up with copper ions and chloride ions. That's right. And then we essentially evaporated the water, so the dipoles were taken away, and you ended up with a pure compound again. Outstanding. You're right. Okay. So how do you know that ions are there, besides me just telling you and me being a fascist authority figure? Something called electrolytes, all right? Electrolytes, which are more than the things in just in Gatorade, are actually little ions and stuff that form. And if you put electricity into them, the electricity will conduct. Here's an example of how an electrolyte test goes down. This is actually, like Mackenzie just talked about, a copper chloride solution. All right, you can see it's kind of like got a blue color like ours did too. If you put electricity in and it goes all the way through, so you can imagine electricity is going from one side to the other and the light bulb comes on, that electricity is being conducted. So an electrolyte is just nothing more than a solution that conducts electricity. Now, believe it or not, if you put electrodes into pure water with no ions or anything like that, the electricity does not go through. Water doesn't allow actually electricity to go through. However, you all heard about people, you know, they're blow drying their hair while taking a bath and, you know, it goes in the water and it's like Halloween, electricity, electrocuting themselves and stuff. It's not the water's fault per se. Our bodies have so many ions, sodium ions and who knows what kind of other ions. Our bodies give a lot of ions into the water which make them conductive, and that's why please do not blow dry your hair while taking a bath because it's a bad scene. So anyway, an electrolyte conduces electricity if you put it through. A strong electrolyte is nothing more than something that is 100% dissociated. So you have the maximum amount of electricity going through. Strong electrolytes have K pluses, Mg pluses, Na pluses, H pluses, some kind of positives, and they'll also have, going back to what Blake asked about, a negative one. So they might have a Cl minus or an MnO4 minus, Cl minus, Cl minus. They're going to have ions to conduct the electricity through. And you can actually then observe this and stuff if you pump some energy through.
A strong electrolyte is a compound that ionizes completely in solution. Hydrogen chloride breaks into hydrogen and chlorine ions.
hydrochloric acid is actually H plus ions and Cl minus ions. You don't really have any HCl in the acid form. HCl is a strong electrolyte. All the positives break up from all the negatives, which goes back to what Blake said just a little bit ago. Now, Blake also did ask a good question.
A weak electrolyte is a compound that only partially ionizes in solution. Some hydrogen ions dissociate from acetic acid molecules, but others may rebond at the same time.
If something is an electrolyte at all, it has to break up into even positives and negatives. But some compounds are really happy by themselves. They don't really care to be positives and negatives. This is acetic acid, active ingredient in vinegar. And really, acetic acid is pretty happy. But one in 10,000 molecules, and we'll talk about in 223, yeah, you can predict that. One in 10,000 or so, they dissociate. So in this case, it's the acidic H plus that comes off, and you're left with acetate. Now, these two will recombine to each other because they really like being with each other, but there is a little bit of dissociation. A weak electrolyte, if you place electricity in a solution of it, you'll see a dull light bulb, all right? It doesn't have a very good conductivity. It goes through a little bit, but not as much as it did when it was a strong electrolyte. And then finally, you can have a non-electrolyte, which is a solution that dissolves in water, but it doesn't conduct electricity. Notice how in the first one with the strong electrolytes, those were all like metals and non-metals, or H plus ions and acids with their anions. These non-electrolytes are things like sugar. They dissolve in water, but they don't break up into ions. If you try and put electricity through them, they don't conduct.
Some compounds that dissolve in water, such as ethanol, do not dissociate into ions at all. Such compounds are called non-electrolytes.
Non-electrolytes include ethanol, which is drinking alcohol, caffeine, things like that. They're mostly non-metal plus non-metal compounds that do dissolve in water. Sugar water would be an example of a non-electrolyte. Sugar is also a combination of things that doesn't break up into positives and negatives. So to summarize then these last three slides, if you have a cation and an anion, you first want to check to see if it dissolves. Dissolves mean that the solid disappears and it looks like a solution. And then if it does dissolve, almost all of them will conduct electricity and become electrolytes. However, if you have a non-metal plus a non-metal compound, and these are the sugars and the ethanols and the caffeines, a lot of times they will dissolve in water as well, but they won't conduct electricity because they don't have that cation-anion thing. So think about strong electrolytes and non-electrolytes mostly.
What would happen if you had like sugary salt water? Would it, we have like a weak transmission? Or would it
probably. It would depend on the quantity of salt to sugar. Now, acids are great electrolytes usually, especially the strong ones. And some of the strong acids that we'll talk about a lot are hydrochloric, nitric, perchloric, and sulfuric. Now, all the acids have H listed first if the formula is done right. So a strong acid is nothing more than a strong electrolyte. These are the ones you don't want to put on your hands. They will burn.
Hydrochloric acid is a strong acid. The compound hydrogen chloride ionizes completely, so many ions are free in the solution.
Those little H plus ions are the ones that will feel like something's burning. You gotta be really careful by those. However,
a water molecule consists of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. Water molecules are attracted to a hydrogen ion or proton to form a conglomeration. There are often six and sometimes more water molecules around an ion. Because the hydrogen ion is so small, it is thought to have an average of four water molecules associated with it at any time.
It's water's fault that acids are acids. Notice here the V-type form. This is like what Jessica asked about a little bit ago. Water has a negative and a positive side. The oxygen side we're going to see is a slightly negative. They surround the H plus ions and they basically pull them away. So the hydronium ion, which is a type of an acid, is nothing more than a water that's pulled an H plus off an acid. And hydronium is something we'll talk about later. If you hear hydronium, just think about it as water plus an H plus.
Hydrofluoric acid is a weak acid because it only partially ionizes. At any one moment, most of the HF molecules have not split into their ions.
Acetic acid, carbonic acid, phosphoric acid, and literally thousands upon thousands of other acids, though, are weak acids, which just means that they don't break up 100% into H pluses and whatever else is left. These guys are more benign. Most of what we eat and drink is actually acidic, and most of our foods and drinks then have some of these kind of acids in them. So phosphoric acid is in a lot of sodas and stuff. Carbonic acid is in a lot of the water we drink because of the CO2 reacting with water. These guys are usually not as powerful, and there's lots of different uses for them. Questions?
But it's powerful enough to affect our oceans on a large enough scale for carbonic acid.
All chemicals have the potential for lots of things, absolutely. All right, this is a good place to stop. We'll do starting stuff with bases on Wednesday. Have a great summer.